This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. Katie Ann McDonald producing, and we're joined by Dan Moldea from the nation's capital. Much happening in Washington, as it usually is, and in the Trump age, every day was an adventure, and even though Donald Trump has now been out of office for 6 months and 6 days, he remains a figure of unparalleled attention, and much of what's happening in Washington is related to him. And we're going to start there. We will cover some ground with Dan Moldea, who also is the top reporter of all time on the Jimmy Hoffa trail. It was 46 years ago this week that Jimmy Hoffa disappeared from the Red Fox restaurant outside Detroit and has never been found. Dan thinks he knows where the remains are located. 877-217-5757. The insurrection, it would seem, would be an easy call for lawmakers to say, look, let's look into see what's happened after all the nation's capital was overtaken, Dan. But as we know, it's not an easy sell. Why not?
Because it wasn't black people who were attacking the Capitol. I mean, let's face it, if the Capitol insurrection had been Black Lives Matter doing what these white guys did to the Capitol on January 6th, A, there would have been a lot of dead black guys all over the Capitol grounds. And secondly, there would have been investigations all over the world at the inspiration of the Republicans. This is all about black and white. That's what it's all about. It's what it's everything's about, really. And that's why the Republicans won't do anything on this. They are terrified of Donald Trump. They're terrified of his kooky base. And, I mean, I have friends, as I'm sure you do, Jim, who are Trump supporters. But, I mean, and I tolerate that up until the election. But all the damage this guy's done since the election has been so irresponsible. And anyone who still supports him after the Capitol insurrection and the nonsense of the Stop the Steal election thing, which is the big lie, I not only question my friends' politics anymore, I question their basic sense of right and wrong. This is nonsense what's going on, and we have to start, you know, judging our friends by their, you know, once again, their basic sense of right and wrong. And people who support the Capitol insurrection, people who still support Donald Trump and his support or his inspiration of or his inciting that Capitol insurrection, you know, we have to reevaluate our relationships with these people in our lives.
Many members of Congress are in that number, including Jim Jordan, the person, one of them, that Kevin...
He's a nutcase. He's a nutcase.
Well, he was going to be on the panel investigating the insurrection if Kevin McCarthy...
But that's Kevin McCarthy. That's Kevin McCarthy, who bragged on Fox News that he had created the Benghazi Committee strictly for the sole purpose of going after Hillary Clinton. You know... Kevin McCarthy is the embodiment of the whorehouse that is American politics today. And his relentless pursuit of the speakership of the House, which he's hoping to get if the Republicans, God forbid, would take the House in 2022, would be a disaster of monumental proportions, because you would have, you know, basically stooges of Donald Trump running the government yet again.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for Dan Moldea. David in Atlanta. David, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. You know, Al Sharpton said if he would have pointed a crowd to attack the Capitol, what would the Republicans be saying? You know, to give you an example of how reckless, dangerous, and irresponsible and crazy Trump is, the Wall Street Journal wrote yesterday that Iran is enriching uranium to the level of pure uranium. Trump tore up the nuclear agreement that President Obama negotiated, got nothing in return for it, and Trump brags about this at his rallies. The man is totally insane, irresponsible, reckless, and dangerous.
All right, Dan, your response to your friend David in Atlanta.
I think that's my friend David in Atlanta, who is my favorite caller in when I'm on your show, Jim. David is a very intelligent man, and I always enjoy listening to him. I agree with David. It's nonsensical and it's crazy. And the amazing thing is, I don't know what we have to do with our friends. Literally, I mean, I have family members who I will forgive. There's, you know, I have first cousins who I love. I mean, let's face it, our first cousins were our first friends in life, and I love these people. But they have drunk the Kool-Aid, And there's a family reunion next month, which I'm not going to, because I don't want there to be a moment of unpleasantness where everyone gets into this, even though everyone would go into it deciding to avoid it. So it's an interesting situation. David is exactly right. This is about Donald Trump.
All right, emails if you prefer it that way. And, of course, we like calls at 877-217-5757, emails at talk@talklouisiana.org. Former Senator Dan Ritchie, who's been a guest on this show, says that it was Black Lives Matter and Antifa that caused the commotion at the Capitol on January 6th. Senator Ritchie is not alone in that point of view, but, Dan, that has been totally debunked.
Well, of course. I mean, look at the pictures. If you want to really be shocked, look at the montage, the film, the 40-minute film that the New York Times put together about the insurrection from soup to nuts, narrated. It is breathtaking in its scope. It is breathtaking in what this was all about and Trump's role in it. And I highly suggest getting this 40-minute film that the New York Times put together. It is absolutely wonderful. And anyone who thinks that Antifa or Black Lives Matter were involved in this Capitol insurrection are people who are beyond help. These are people who, you know, these people should go to Austria and have teams of psychiatrists evaluate them 7 days a week, 24/7. It's nonsensical.
I didn't see too many Black folks storming the Capitol.
I didn't either. I didn't either, Jim. I didn't either. No. Like I said, if there had been this had been a Black insurrection, there would have been a lot of dead guys all over the Capitol grounds. These guys wouldn't have hesitated to take care of business. And also, there would have been calls for investigations by the Republicans, demands for investigations, which would have never ceased. I can't believe that and I got to tell you, I'm no fan of Liz Cheney, but you know, I got to hand it to her for standing up to the Republican minority leader the way and to the caucus as she has. I got to hand it to her. I don't know if Trump dissed her father or something. The other thing is that her father, you know, Dick Cheney, he may be a creep, but he does have good. He does have he's a smart guy and he knows politics. And I would imagine he and his friends, who are very high profile, powerful guys, I'm sure, have read the tea leaves on this thing, and they probably view Liz Cheney as being a visionary.
Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Patrick, you're on with Dan. Good morning, Patrick.
Hey, good morning. I don't see too many Black people at Black Lives Matter protests either. A lot of them are mostly white, socialist, communist types. And I do think if BLM, which is a Marxist group, has nothing to do with Black Lives, and Antifa stormed the Capitol, it would have been destroyed completely, would have been burned to the ground. I think what you saw in the insurrection was pretty minimal damage compared to the protests and the riots that we saw all summer, last summer.
All right, just some harmless tourists were at the Capitol on January 6th, Dan.
Well, I hear what he's saying. What he's doing is, I mean, the caller is, he's got a point of view, no doubt about it. We disagree with it. But, you know, he is, obviously, he is a concerned citizen who's talking about violence, whether it's violence on the left or the right. And, man, we got to stand up against the violence, whether it is from the left or from the right. This is the time for cool heads. I mean, it's amazing. You have a bill before Congress, a voting rights bill, named after John Lewis, for heaven's sakes, who is one of the great peace guys of all time, one of the proteges of Martin Luther King. I wrote speeches for John Lewis when he was at the Action Agency. I was assistant. It was the last job I had before I became a full-time writer and author. And I was executive assistant to the deputy director. And John Lewis was deputy director to the director of, I think it was domestic relations or something. It was a division within the Action Agency, the volunteer agency. And I had the honor to be writing a few speeches for John Lewis. And this was a wonderful guy who taught peace and love and compromise and diplomacy. And in his name and spirit, we should be looking for ways to, you know, roll back the violence that's going on. So the caller, obviously, I disagree with what he said, but I understand what's behind it. He is concerned about the violence, whether it's from the left or the right, and I agree with him on that.
Switching gears to another topic today, front page New York Times, officials fight to vaccinate in Louisiana. Dr. Martha White, the top public health official in the northwest corner of our state, was sitting in the back of a city council meeting on a muggy day when she was called to the front of the room to respond to an attack on the coronavirus vaccine. Candy Peavy, a resident, warned that the Biden administration would send people door to door to document unvaccinated Americans, a false but widespread conspiracy theory. Not only that, Ms. Peavy told the hundreds in attendance, the vaccine was an experimental gene therapy that had killed thousands in the U.S. We should refuse to be tracked, discriminated against, bribed, controlled, threatened, shamed, or coerced into compliance. She shouted to applause. Dr. White calmly began a practice monologue on the vaccine. It does not integrate into one's DNA, she said. No one in Louisiana has died from the vaccine, one of the safest ever produced, and several women yelled and swore at her before they were asked to leave. That is what is going on with this coronavirus surge, number four. And now Clay Higgins, the controversial congressman from Acadiana, has it for a second time. We'll talk with this about Dan Moldeo when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Katie Ann McDonald producing. Dan Moldeo with us for just a bit longer. Your number is 877-217-5757. Dan, have you been vaccinated?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I waited my turn and everything. I waited patiently. But as soon as I was eligible for it, I was there. I was there and getting my vaccine. I got my two Pfizers. And I was we are unabashed about going into restaurants now and everything else, although we are concerned about this other thing. We stay masked when we go to supermarkets and things like that. But, as you know, once we enter a restaurant masked and sit at the table, we have no problems taking off the mask and interacting with people around us who also clearly have gotten the vaccination.
Rose in Goodwood. Rose, you're on Talk Louisiana with Dan Moldea. Hi, Rose.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm calling about the vaccine again. If we keep not getting vaccinated, this is going to end up killing us all, because as it varies, it makes us sicker, and it's hurting people not to get vaccinated.
I totally agree with that. By osmosis, I know nothing about this subject, but Dr. Fauci, I live here in Washington. Dr. Fauci lives a drive and a five iron from me. And there are signs all over the neighborhood where it's saying, God bless for Dr. Fauci, thank goodness for Dr. Fauci, support Dr. Fauci. This is a beloved man who has been nothing but a public servant throughout his career, and he deserves our gratitude for shepherding us through this. He's our guardian angel through this entire situation. Mm-hmm. And those people who are trashing this guy ought to be called out as well. Dr. Fauci is an American hero.
He is being attacked, though. Ouchie Fauci, they're calling him. Now, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, quite possibly the next governor of the great state of Arkansas, wrote in the pages of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette yesterday that she got vaccinated because President Trump got vaccinated. She wrote, Dan, that if getting vaccinated was safe enough for him, it's safe enough for me. So why doesn't Donald Trump get out there and say, look, folks, this is real, get vaccinated?
Because he doesn't care about anybody but himself. I mean, let's face it. I mean, listen, the litmus test here is what happened on January 6th. The most loyal person in the whole world to Donald Trump was Mike Pence, his vice president. Nobody was more loyal to him. No one stood by him like Mike Pence did. And what did Donald Trump do? He pointed his finger at him. He said he was the guy who was blocking his ability to remain in office. And what did the mob do? They went after Mike Pence. Mike Pence could have easily lost his life that day. And that's what Donald Trump brought. He is loyal to no one.
James in Metairie. James, you're on with Dan. Hi, James.
Hi, Jim and Dan. A couple of things. Dan mentioned that the Trump cult followers are saying that it was Antifa and BLM who started and aggravated the situation on January 6th. Let's not forget that a lot of the Trump cult followers also believe that the FBI was in that crowd agitating and causing the violence.
What about this anti-government sentiment by some of the Trump people?
I'm sure that that's to me. That's addressed to me.
Yes.
Oh, I agree with the gentleman. The FBI is being blamed irresponsibly for this. Listen, I love the FBI right now. I'm in the midst of trying to find Jimmy Hoffa's body, and I have given everything I know to the FBI. I am now waiting patiently here while they deal with all of these very important 21st century problems the Capitol insurrection, the cyber warfare that's going on, and all the other 21st century problems that are before they come back and solve a 20th century mystery, which I believe I have solved.
All right, we're going to get to that in just a bit. Please be brief in your remarks to Dan. Jim and Walker. Jim, you're on. Good morning.
Absolutely. The reason why Donald Trump will not get on television, et cetera, and tell everybody to get the vaccine because it works is because if he admits that he lied about that, then everyone will know that, you know, he was lying about other stuff too.
All right.
That's Jim. A fact. And to me, the unsung hero of the 2020 election is Bob Woodward, the author who wrote the book about Trump, the guy who interviewed Trump on tape and revealed the conversation he had with Trump on February 7th, 2020, before everyone was going, you know, to war with the coronavirus. And Trump said on tape that he knew on as late as February 7th that the coronavirus was airborne. And meantime, he was demeaning people who were wearing masks and everything else. I believe that's what made the coronavirus the number one issue of the campaign, and I think that's why Joe Biden is president today. God bless Bob Woodward for what he did.
Alex in City Park. Alex, you're on with Dan.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for taking the call. Just wanted to just chime in. I'm like a lot of other people. I'm concerned about the violence. But it's been a few months since January 6th. But I've noticed, you know, an observation, like a lot of people have noticed, that there's a large contingent of people that are almost offended that we have a vaccine out there, and it's getting worse. And I wouldn't say it's directly tied to political affiliation, but it certainly leans that way. I see people on social media actually ridiculing people, and I wouldn't say they're making up stories, but it's kind of like, are you going to go with science?
Are you going to go with science, or are you going to go with something else? Science is usually a pretty good.
Science is good enough for me.
Yeah, okay. Well, 46 years ago this week, as in July 30th, Jimmy Hoffa, 55 years old, world famous, former Teamsters leader at that time, trying to get his old job back. He went to a restaurant and suburban Detroit, and he never came back. And Dan has been following it since day one. He has been the reporter. He thinks he knows where Jimmy is buried. And we still don't know what happened on July 30th, 1975. Could you give us the condensed version of what happened when Jimmy went to that restaurant?
Sure. What happened was, in Act One, Hoffa went to this restaurant, the Red Fox, and he was going to have a meeting with, he expected a meeting with two mafia guys, Tony Jacalone and Tony Provenzano, as well as a labor racketeer named Lenny Schultz. He is picked up by somebody, person's unknown, and he disappears. In Act 2, he's murdered, goes to somebody's place, he's murdered. In Act 3, his body's disposed of. Shortly after the murder, there was a federal informant who told the FBI that Hoffa was murdered in Detroit, stuffed into a 55-gallon drum, loaded onto a Gateway truck, and shipped to New Jersey. When they asked him to speculate, he said, I think he was buried in this dump in Jersey City, New Jersey, Brother Moscato's dump. In 2007, I interviewed Brother Moscato, and Brother Moscato admitted to me on tape, this mafia guy, he's a soldier in the Vito Genovese crime family, and he admitted to me that Hoffa's body was buried at Brother Moscato's dump. He had a partner at the dump named Paul Coppola. In February of 2019, Paul Coppola's son, Paul Coppola Jr., called me and said that his older brother, Frank Coppola, knew something about the Hoffa case. It took me 7 months to interview Frank, but I interviewed him, and during the seven phone calls we had, he told me the story about his father. We met in New Jersey on September 29th, 28th for dinner on a Saturday night, September 28, 2019. He said he was going to go to the dump the next day. I said, you are taking me with you. We went. He gave me a 45-minute tour of the area. He showed me the exact location of Hoffa's body. He said that his father had buried Hoffa at the bottom of a 15-foot hole, put 15 to 30 steel drums on top of it. On November 24th, we went there for the GPR, ground penetrating radar, and exactly where Frank told us the body was, we found a 12 by 15-foot perimeter of steel drums detected by the ground-penetrating radar. Right now, we are waiting for the FBI, which has completely shut this area down. You can't even get close to it right now. We're waiting for the FBI, who ran a search warrant on this place. This is the first place they thought the body was after they heard from this federal informant, Ralph Picardo, in 1975. In December 1975, they did a search of the dump. They couldn't find it because it's a 34-acre area, and they didn't know exactly where to look. But right now, this will be a complete and total vindication for the FBI's entire 46-year investigation, if I'm right, and I am right, and it's going to be a vindication for my 46-year investigation, well, too. I am Ahab, and the Hoffa case is my white whale. This is it. I'm catching the white whale.
Catching the white whale.
Stay tuned.
And if it weren't for you, I don't think we'd be where we are today on this. And you.
The only person who knew where he buried Hoffa was Paul Coppola. The only person he told was his son, who died in March of 2020. So he handed it off to me just before he died. And then I was the only one who knew. And then I just made it public. I decided to make it public.
All right, we're going to wrap it up with Dan Moldeo when we return. And then I think we're going to hear from the John Carlos, after this. Pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're wrapping it up with Dan Moldea, the intrepid investigative reporter, author many, many years ago of the Hoffa Wars. And in just a moment, we're going to hear from John Carlos. He wrote his memoir a few years ago, The John Carlos Story, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. That was the 1968 Olympics. And here we are in 2021 and another summer Olympics, and John Carlos is here to provide context to then and now. But before we get to John, Dan, I didn't want to cut you short. This could be a tremendous vindication for you. You've been chasing the...
And for the FBI. I'm excited about you having John Carlos on. I knew Tommy Smith. He was teaching at Oberlin, and, you know, what a great guy. And you described it exactly right. It was a tremendous moment in American history and certainly in American sports. So John Carlos, I've never met him, don't know him. Big fan. God bless John Carlos.
But good luck with Jimmy Hoffa's remains.
Stay tuned, Jim.
We will, and we'll be in touch. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. And Dr. John Carlos is with us. John Wesley Carlos, born in Harlem, but in 1968, when he was 23 years old, he and Tommy Smith did something that at the time was extremely controversial. It would be controversial today, the Black Power salute on the podium as they won their medals in the Olympics of 1968 in the 200 meters at Mexico City. And John Carlos, all these years later, I'm sure you are fully aware that you paid a price that was immense by doing this, and I suspect you have no regrets. So what are your thoughts about what you did then and how it has resonated so many years later?
Well, as you stated, no regrets whatsoever. I think that as a young man, I'm happy now in my senior years that I can look back, reflect on those days, and think that, of course, you've done the right thing, John, despite all the hoopla and this, let's say the people had no knowledge other than the headlines that they read. Mm-hmm. Now people are a lot more educated, a lot more assertive in terms of them venting their minds to, you know, reason with themselves as to whether something was right or wrong, opposed to letting the headlines lead them. So it's always good to make a statement in society and then live through the statement that you made.
Well, you took 35 years to be inducted into the USA Track and Field Hall of Fame, 2003. That's after the 68 Olympics. And John went on to set world records in several events, including the 100 meters. Ran the 100 yards in 9.1 seconds. That's moving like few, if any, humans in the history of the world have. Do you think that this cost you, not only financially, that's obvious, but in other ways that were profound through the years?
Well, you know, in any type of statement that an individual is going to make, you're going to suffer and you're going to sacrifice. And that was understood before I made the statement. Relative to any world records or so forth that I've set in my career, I've always taken the stance that world records are set for the nation that you represent, or the city or town or the school that you represent, more than hanging it on my neck. I can't go to the grocery store and feed my kids off of it. I can't walk into the Fortune 500 and get a job based on it. So, as I stated earlier, more records are for the people in the nation that you represent. I have no problem with what they do. That's up to them. You know, I sit back and reflect on Mexico City as a whole and think about how disenchanted they were by what they were spectating. And at the same time, no matter how disenchanted they were, when the medal count went on the board, they never took my medal down. So they didn't disown me 100%.
How did this come about with you and Tommy Smith? Whose idea was it?
It was my idea. It was my idea. You know, this is something that I had in me from the initial start when we collectively tried to get together to stage a boycott of the games. Many individuals felt like they owed it to their families, to their communities, to their church, to themselves, to go to the Olympic Games and attempt to win a medal. We had no right to tell them that you have to pass the games. All we could do was make a suggestion and then try and put some sort of education foundation as to why we felt they should take this step. However, they decided they wanted to go, and we applauded that. Go. But yet and still, when they went, I was disenchanted. And at one point, I was thinking about staying home. And, you know, it's a funny thing, man. You know, spirituality comes and reach your mind sometimes. And this particular day, it came to me and it said, John, you know, you can stay on from the games.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, when someone steps into your spot and go into victory stand, will they represent you the way you feel you need to be represented? That was the catalyst to me actually making the team and going on to Mexico. But when I got to Mexico, I was still, you know, concerned about making a statement for society to let them know that we have a little brush fire right now. And if we don't get up off our butts to try and resolve this issue, it's going to turn into a raging forest fire. So I approached Mr. Smith and let him know that I was disenchanted about the boycott being called off and I wanted to make a statement. What was his take? Well, he was 100% with me. And from that point on, then we went to gather artifacts that we had that we could bring to the podium because we wanted to signify certain instances to our society that we're confronted with.
Did you know it would change the world?
Well, I had a prelude because when I was a kid, the powers to be in this universe gave me a vision. And the same thing that happened to me on that box as a kid, 7, 8 years old, happened to me 15 years later on that victory stand, the exact same situation. So I had a prelude, although at that particular time, I didn't really realize that vision had a sole connection with what happened that day, October 16th.
Jim in University Hills. Jim, please be brief. You're on with the incomparable John Carlos.
I met John at the Orange County Relays, I believe, when I was a teenager, and got his autograph on my program. I wish I had that program today. You were a great inspiration to me as a track athlete and as a principled man. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. I'm just so happy that I took the time to share with you, bro. I appreciate your comments.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with John Carlos.
Mr. Carlos, you're my role model. As I have protested against federal judges' bias in favor of employers against employees in discrimination cases.
All right. You've inspired many people, many you've never met. And that's a sobering thought to know that you've influenced people that you'll never meet. And in most cases, I think in positive ways.
Well, you know, you sit back and think about all those people that I've influenced. We all in the same blood. You know, they feel, they have emotions, they have concerns. They have a moral compass the same as I do. That's the people that I reach. Those individuals, I'm very happy that I've reached them, but there's other individuals out there that seem to be confused about what real society life is all about.
Your father, most people would not know. He was born in 1895, so he was 50 in his 50s when you were born, but he fought in World War I. Earl V. Carlos Sr. Now, tell us about him, and you know, you're obviously were from a patriotic family. What influence did he have?
Oh, my father had a tremendous influence on me. I mean, he taught me everything from day one. You know, he taught me the value of education. He taught me about love, taught me about love of family. gave me the history of a black man in the military back at that time, what was happening during the war. He told me, explained to me what happened to them when they came home from the war. And, you know, a lot of things that he said is kind of parallel with, you know, going to represent America in the Olympic Games as well. I mean, you were revered highly while you were on the front line. But when you get back home, then, you know, you're just a side note, so to speak.
Dr. John Carlos is our guest for a bit longer. If you'd like to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757. One of the great athletes of all time, and at 6'4", now Usain Bolt was about your size, or is about your size, but a lot of, as you know, track and field sprinters are not tall people. They get out of the blocks quickly if they're not tall. How did you get started so quickly at 6'4"?
Well, I guess you could say it's determination. I think the thing that intrigued me more, I enjoyed running the 200 meters. I was very comfortable running the 200 meters. But I think I started running the 60 and the 100 based on the fact that they were stating it just what you said. A taller individual can't run the 60-yard dash, or a taller individual can't run the 100-yard dash. And I just wanted to prove them wrong. You know, I could run anything that I basically put my mind to running. A lot of people don't know when I started out as a model. I wasn't a sprinter. I was just intrigued with the sprints. And told the coach that I could run and I could beat those guys. He didn't believe me quite naturally. But eventually, I had to tell the coach, if you don't let me run the 100, I'm going to quit the track team. So he figured he'll embarrass me and put me in the 300. And I got in there and I won the 300. And then he dropped me down again. And eventually, I got the chance to run the 100. And I liked it. I found my niche in the 200, and that's been my career in track and field, running the sprints.
Well, you've set world records, 9-1, 100 yards. They were running 100 yards then. Do you feel that you missed out as far as the big endorsement money that track and field athletes now receive?
You know, it has to be a catalyst in order for these young individuals to receive the money that they receive now. And the money that they receive now is not really a tremendous amount of money. You know, people look at professional athletes and the track and field athletes on the lower end of that scale. But I'm happy to see that they're getting something, opposed to when I was competing, they give me $2 a day.
How much? How much do they get? $2 a day?
$2 a day. That was our thing. And if you got $2 in the penny, they classify you as being a professional athlete.
Oh, my goodness. We'll spend a few more minutes with the incomparable Dr. John Wesley Carlos. 1968, 53 years ago, as you can tell, this man's still full of vim and vigor. And then it's Earl Swift. His book is Across the Airless Wilds. Back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana as the 2021 Olympics are going on in Tokyo. And in the early going, China has the most medals. The U.S. has the most gold medals. John Carlos, hero of 1968, an anti-hero at the time. He is with us to reflect on his life and times for just a few more moments. We have so many people have tried to get in that we won't be able to take all of you. Hopefully we can get back John back soon. But please be brief in your remarks, and we'll get to a few of you before we part company with the remarkable John Carlos. Rich downtown. Rich, you're on with John. Hi, Rich.
Hey, how's it going? How are you guys doing this morning?
What's your question?
I was just, I wanted to ask John Carlos, first of all, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Of course, as so many have said, you've inspired so many people. I've got a couple friends that are running in the Olympics, actually, right now, track and field athletes, some for the States and some for Great Britain. I was wondering if you were of competition age, I guess, for the lack of better terms, how would you feel about the Olympics currently? Would you feel the same way that you felt back in Mexico?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I don't think that things have changed drastically since 1968 relative to social justice and so forth here in the United States and other parts of the world for that matter. So, yes, if I was there, I would be, you know, politically conscious as to what's happening in society, and I would do what I feel is necessary to bring attention to those individuals that's basically voiceless.
Zach in South Baton Rouge. Hi, Zach. You're on with John Carlos.
Good morning. It's a pleasure, Mr. Carlos. I spoke to you some time ago. My name is Zach. I own the art gallery here in Baton Rouge. I still have a poster of that picture right now here in my home right now. You, along with Muhammad Ali, was my heroes as a child. So I want to thank you for your courage. And I'm just a pleasure to know I spoke to you at least once in my life.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Now, you're 3 years younger than Muhammad Ali, 3.5 years. What did you make of him, since Zach brought it up, as a iconic figure who also changed the world, but also a great athlete, maybe the greatest boxer ever? Your thoughts about Ali?
Ali was a very dear friend of mine. You might say we were like two bookends. You know, he had to support me and have my back, and I had to support him and have his back. Because both of our ideals and thoughts about society were we were pretty like balanced, leveled off. We was on that seesaw together, you know. So I admired his courage. I admired his vision. And I admired the fact that he chose to step up once again for those that couldn't step up for themselves.
He gave his best 3.5 years as an athlete for a cause. He was not allowed to box between the ages of 25 and 29, and those are, as you know, prime years for an athlete. What would have happened?
Particularly for a boxer. Mm-hmm. You know, it just goes to show, I mean, America has a track record. We can follow a track record and say for so many years, individuals that might have stepped out of the circle and been defiant, those are the individuals that had to suffer in terms of employment. But yet still, when you sit back and you think about those individuals that kept their mouths shut and didn't make any statements or any qualms about anything, this is the greatest nation in the world. We had the largest Fortune 500 industry in the world. And you sit back and you think about how many athletes of color have gone to represent America and come home from the Olympic Games and can't feed themselves, can't feed their families. When we used to take off and go to Europe and be in Europe for 2.5 months or 3 months, who's filling the void there when you have your bills mounting up at home and you are representing glory? And then we get home and realize that glory never represented me. These are things that people need to be really considering in their mind and think to themselves whether this is a just situation or not. You know, and then for them to say you don't have a right to get on the victory stand and express your emotions or your feelings. It's great to represent America, but it's bad for us to represent ourselves. That seems to be the call for many individuals.
John Carlos, a pleasure talking with you. I hope we visit again soon. Thank you, sir.
You take care. Give my best to Doc as well.
I will do it. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. And we're joined now by Earl Swift. His book is Across the Airless Wilds. The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. Apollo 17 astronauts Eugene Cernan and Harrison Jack Schmidt break to a stop alongside Nansen Crater, keenly aware that they were far, far from home. They had flown nearly 250,000 miles to the man in the moon's left eye, landed at the edge, then driven 5 miles to a desolate boulder-strewn hole, and as they gathered rock samples, they strode at the outermost edge of man's travels. This place, this moment, marked extremes for a species born to wander. That's from the remarkable Earl Swift. Now, Earl, we of course focus on 1969 and the first moon landing with Neil Armstrong and Michael Collins and Buzz Aldrin, but much came after that in the immediate years, and you have followed it closely. Have we not given the attention that we should to what occurred after the moon landing of 1969?
Jim, thanks for having me. I think that everything that came after Apollo 11 has dimmed in its shadow, and it's a shame because what came after completely eclipsed what was accomplished, and that's not to shortchange Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin for, you know, I mean, they were the first to step onto another celestial body. But just to put it in perspective, their wanderings during the Apollo 11 mission would fit inside a football field with a lot of room to spare. 2 years later, with Apollo 15, which launched 50 years ago today, by the way, Dave Scott and Jim Irwin drove more than 17 miles in their lunar rover. They climbed hundreds of feet up the side of a mountain the size of Kilimanjaro. They explored the edge of a canyon that was a mile wide and 1,000 feet deep. They crisscrossed an undulating plain collecting samples along the way to collect hundreds of pounds of samples. And yet, I think most Americans would be hard-pressed to name any member of the crew.
Have those findings been pertinent as far as what they have resonated to this day, as far as their relevance?
Even as we speak, there are moon rocks being studied and yielding insights into the origins not only of the moon, but of Earth, the solar system, the galaxy. It's the moon's a time capsule, so it's a really valuable focus of study. You know, everything on Earth changes constantly, thanks to weather and volcanism and plate tectonics and what have you. The moon has been dead since infancy, so it is as it's always been pretty much for at least the last 4 billion years or so. And it makes it a really fruitful place to dig.
We're visiting with Earl Swift. He's been nominated 7 times for the Pulitzer for his work. He is one of the key students of moon landings, and as mentioned, we focus a lot on Apollo 11, but there were other missions, 15, 16, 17, 15, an anniversary today, but those missions were groundbreaking as well. As you note, they picked up where the others left off, and we don't give them the vast attention that we should, and we quit going to the moon. Why did we quit going to the moon?
Well, the short answer is money. We were in the middle of a financially ruinous war at the time. We were facing a host of social issues, pretty serious social issues at home. And there was a growing public unrest with the notion of spending $500 million per trip to the moon when, the consensus, the growing consensus seemed to be that money would be better spent a lot closer to home.
What did we miss by not doing it?
Well, I think that from the very beginning, Apollo was always seen as the first chapter in a long lunar campaign that would eventually lead to, ultimately to the colonization, the establishment of some sort of long-term presence on the moon. And had we gone that route, I think it's quite likely that we would have had human crews on Mars by now. And, we would have just become much more adept at making a home in really hostile environments, which is, mm-hmm. of course, what the moon requires. It's about as hostile a place as you can imagine.
A listener asked about these rich guys, the most recent Jeff Bezos, going into space. Do you make much of this?
Oh, yeah. This is good stuff. It's competition, and it's private sector competition. We always, we always had, I think there's a perception of the earlier space program as being kind of a government monopoly, and it wasn't. There was a great deal of private side competition among contractors for NASA contracts. But to see these very different approaches to the problems, that's something new, because we don't have a NASA playing overseer and winnowing down the options. We've got 3 very well-heeled competitors coming up with very different ways of approaching the same problem. So, it's exciting. Well, it'll yield good things.
Yeah, you're an adventurer. I thought you'd like what they're doing, but it is a new world to have guys like Bezos and Elon Musk trying to do what others have done so successfully many moons ago. And the book is Across the Airless Wilds from Merle Swift. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for our program. Until tomorrow, thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.